Musicians joined in and dropped out at will, all but the drummer, who never stopped his subtle, changing beat. The two old dancers were still dancing at sixth hour, midnight, after 5 Terran hours. This was the first time I had seen the phenomenon of Dothi, the voluntary, controlled use of what we call hysterical strength. And thereafter, I was readier to believe tales concerning the old men of the Handara. It was an introverted life, self-sufficient, stagnant, steeped in that singular ignorance prized by the Handarata, and obedient to their rule of inactivity or non-interference. That rule, expressed in the word Nasuth, which I have to translate as no matter, is the heart of the cult, and I don't pretend to understand it. But I began to understand Karhide better after a half month in Otherhord. Under that nation's politics and parades and passions runs an old darkness, passive, anarchic, silent, the fecund darkness of the Handara. And out of that silence, inexplicably, rises the foreteller's voice. Young Goss, who enjoyed acting as my guide, told me that my question to the foretellers could concern anything and be phrased as I liked. The more qualified and limited the question, the more exact the answer, he said. Vagueness breeds vagueness. And some questions, of course, are not answerable. What if I ask one of those? I inquired. This hedging seemed sophisticated but not unfamiliar. But I did not expect his answer. The weaver will refuse it. Unanswerable questions have wrecked foretelling groups. Wrecked them? Do you know the story of the Lord of Shorth, who forced the foretellers of Asen Fastness to answer the question, what is the meaning of life? Well, it was a couple of thousand years ago. The foreteller stayed in the darkness for 6 days and nights. At the end, all the celibates were catatonic. The zanies were dead. The pervert clubbed the Lord of Shorth to death with a stone. And the weaver, he was a man named Meshi. The founder of the Yomesh cult? Yes, said Goss, and laughed as if the story was very funny, but I didn't know whether the joke was on the Yomeshta or on me. I had decided to ask a yes or no question, which might at least make plain the extent and kind of obscurity or ambiguity in the answer. Facts confirmed what Goss had said, that the matter of the question could be one of which the foretellers were perfectly ignorant. I could ask if the Hulm crops would be good this year in the northern hemisphere of S, and they would answer, having no previous knowledge even of the existence of a planet called S. This seemed to put the business on the plane of pure chance divination, along with yarrow stocks and flipped coins. No, said Fax, not at all. Chance was not involved. The whole process was, in fact, precisely the reverse of chance. Then you mind-read. No, said Fax, with his serene and candid smile. You mind-read without knowing you're doing it, perhaps. What good would that be? If the asker knew the answer, he wouldn't pay our price for it. I chose a question to which I certainly lacked the answer. Only time could prove the foretelling right or wrong, unless it was, as I expected, one of those admirable professional prophecies applicable to any outcome. It was not a trivial question. I had given up the notion of asking when it would stop raining or some such trifle, when I learned that the undertaking was a hard and dangerous one for the 9 foretellers of Otherhord. The cost was high for the asker. 2 of my rubies went to the coffers of the fastness, but higher for the answerers. And as I got to know Fax, if it became difficult to believe that he was a professional faker, it became still more difficult to believe that he was an honest, self-deluded faker. His intelligence was as hard, clear, and polished as my rubies. I dared set no trap for him. I asked what I most wanted to know. On another Hod, the 18th of the month, the 9 met together in a big building, usually kept locked. One high hall, stone-floored and cold, dimly lighted by a couple of slit windows and a fire in the deep hearth at one end. They sat on the bare stone in a circle, all of them, cloaked and hooded, rough steel shapes like a circle of dolmens in the faint glow of the fire yards away. Goss and a couple of other young indwellers and a physician from the nearest domain watched in silence from seats by the hearth while I crossed the hall and entered the circle. It was all very informal and very tense. One of the hooded figures looked up as I came amongst them, and I saw a strange face, coarse-featured, heavy, with insolent eyes watching me. Fax sat cross-legged, not moving, but charged full of a gathering force that made his light, soft voice crack like an electric bolt. "Ask," he said. I stood within the circle and asked my question. "Will this world Gethin be a member of the Ecumen of Known Worlds 5 years from now?" Silence. I stood there. I hung in the center of a spider web woven of silence. "It is answerable," the weaver said quietly. There was a relaxation. The hooded stone seemed to soften into movement. The one who had looked so strangely at me began to whisper to his neighbor. I left the circle and joined the watchers by the hearth. Two of the foretellers remained withdrawn, unspeaking. One of them lifted his left hand from time to time and patted the floor lightly and swiftly 10 or 20 times, then sat motionless again. I had seen neither of them before. They were the Zanies, Goss said. They were insane. Goss called them time dividers, which may mean schizophrenics. Karheidish psychologists, though lacking mind speech and thus like blind surgeons, were ingenious with drugs, hypnosis, spot shock, cryonic touch, and various mental therapies. I asked if these two psychopaths could not be cured. "Cured," Goss said. "Would you cure a singer of his voice?" 5 others of the circle were indwellers of Otherhorde, adepts in the Handara disciplines of presence, and also, said Goss, so long as they remained foretellers, celibate, taking no mate during their periods of sexual potency. One of these celibates must be in Kemmer during the foretelling. I could pick him out, having learned to notice the subtle physical intensification, a kind of brightness, that signalizes the first phase of Kemmer. Beside the Kemmerer sat the pervert. "He came up from Spreeve with the physician," Goss told me. "Some foretelling groups artificially arouse perversion in a normal person, injecting female or male hormones during the days before a session. It's better to have a natural one. He's willing to come, likes the notoriety." Goss used the pronoun that designates a male animal, not the pronoun for a human being in the masculine role of Kemmer. He looked a little embarrassed. "Karheiders discuss sexual matters freely and talk about Kemmer with both reverence and gusto, but they are reticent about discussing perversion. At least they were with me. Excessive prolongation of the Kemmer period, with permanent hormonal imbalance toward the male or the female, causes what they call perversion. It is not rare. 3 or 4% of adults may be physiological perverts or abnormals. Normals, by our standard. They are not excluded from society, but they are tolerated with some disdain, as homosexuals are in many bisexual societies. The Karheidish slang for them is half-deads. They are sterile." The pervert of the group, after that first long, strange stare at me, paid no heed to anyone but the one next to him, the Kemmerer, whose increasingly active sexuality would be further roused and finally stimulated into full female sexual capacity by the insistent, exaggerated maleness of the pervert. The pervert kept talking softly, leaning towards the Kemmerer, who answered little and seemed to recoil. None of the others had spoken for a long time now. There was no sound but the whisper, whisper of the pervert's voice. Fax was steadily watching one of the Zanies. The pervert laid his hand quickly and softly on the Kemmerer's hand. The Kemmerer avoided the touch hastily, with fear or disgust, and looked across at Fax as if for help. Fax did not move. The Kemmerer kept his place and kept still when the pervert touched him again. One of the zanies lifted up his face and laughed a long, false, crooning laugh. Ah, 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 ah. Fax raised his hand. At once, each face in the circle turned to him as if he had gathered up their gazes into a sheaf, a skein. It had been afternoon and raining when we entered the hall. The gray light had soon died out of the slit windows under the eaves. Now whitish strips of light stretched like slanting, phantasmal sails, long triangles and oblongs, from wall to floor, over the faces of the nine. Dull scraps and shreds of light from the moon rising over the forest outside. The fire had burned down long since, and there was no light but those strips and slants of dimness, creeping across the circle, sketching out a face, a hand, a moveless back. For a while I saw Fax's profile, rigid as pale stone in a diffuse dust of light. The diagonal of moonlight crept on and came to a black hump, the Kemmerer, head bowed on his knees, hands clenched on the floor, body shaken by a regular tremor, repeated by the schlutter-pat-pat of the zany's hands on stone, in darkness across the circle. They were all connected, all of them, as if they were the suspension points of a spider web. I felt, whether I wished or not, the connection, the communication that ran wordless, inarticulate, through Fax, and which Fax was trying to pattern and control. For he was the center, the weaver. The dim light fragmented and died away, creeping up the eastern wall. The web of force, of tension, of silence, grew. I tried to keep out of contact with the minds of the foretellers. I was made very uneasy by that silent electric tension, by the sense of being drawn in, of becoming a point or figure in the pattern, in the web. But when I set up a barrier, it was worse. I felt cut off and cowered inside my own mind, obsessed by hallucinations of sight and touch, a stew of wild images and notions, abrupt visions and sensations, all sexually charged and grotesquely violent, a red and black seething of erotic rage. I was surrounded by great gaping pits with ragged lips, vaginas, wounds, hell mouths. I lost my balance. I was falling. If I could not shut out this chaos, I would fall indeed. I would go mad. And there was no shutting it out. The emphatic and paraverbal forces at work, immensely powerful and confused, rising out of the perversion and frustration of sex, out of an insanity that distorts time, and out of an appalling discipline of total concentration and apprehension of immediate reality, were far beyond my restraint or control. And yet, they were controlled. The center was still Fax. Hours and seconds passed. The moonlight shone on the wrong wall. There was no moonlight, only darkness. And in the center of all darkness, Fax. The weaver. A woman. A woman dressed in light. The light was silver. The silver was armor. An armored woman with a sword. The light burned sudden and intolerable, the light along her limbs, the fire, and she screamed aloud in terror and pain, "Yes, yes, yes!" The crooning laugh of the zany began, "Ah, ah, ah, ah," and rose higher and higher into a wavering yell that went on and on, much longer than any voice could go on yelling, right across time. There was movement in the darkness, scuffling and shuffling, a redistribution of ancient centuries, an evasion of foreshadows. "Light, light," said an immense voice in vast syllables, once or innumerable times. Light. Log on the fire there. Some light. It was the physician from Spreve. He had entered the circle. It was all broken. He was kneeling by the zanies, the frailest ones, the fuse points. Both of them lay huddled up on the floor. The Kemmerer lay with his head on Fax's knees, breathing in gasps, still trembling. Fax's hand, with absent gentleness, stroked his hair. The pervert was off by himself in a corner, sullen and dejected. The session was over. Time passed as usual. The web of power had fallen apart into indignity and weariness. Where was my answer? The riddle of the oracle, the ambiguous utterance of prophecy. I knelt down beside Fax. He looked at me with his clear eyes. For that instant, I saw him as I had seen him in the dark, as a woman, armed in light and burning in a fire, crying out, "Yes!" Fax's soft speaking voice broke the vision. "Are you answered, Asker?" "I am answered, Weaver." Indeed, I was answered. 5 years from now, Gethin would be a member of the Ecumen. Yes. No riddles, no hedging. Even then, I was aware of the quality of that answer. Not so much a prophecy as an observation. I could not evade my own certainty that the answer was right. It had the imperative clarity of a hunch. We have novel ships and instantaneous transmission and mind speech, but we haven't yet tamed hunch to run in harness. For that trick, we must go to Gethin. "I serve as the filament," Fax said to me a day or two after the foretelling. "The energy builds up and builds up in us, always sent back and back, redoubling the impulse every time until it breaks through. And the light is in me, around me. I am the light." The old man of Arben Fastness once said that if the weaver could be put in a vacuum at the moment of the answer, he'd go on burning for years. That's what the Omeshta believe of Meshe, that he saw past and future clear. Not for a moment, but all during his life after the question of Shorth. It's hard to believe. I doubt a man could endure it, but no matter. Nasuth, the ubiquitous and ambiguous negative of the Handara. We were strolling side by side, and Fax looked at me. His face, one of the most beautiful human faces I ever saw, seemed hard and delicate as carved stone. "In the darkness," he said, "there were 10, not 9. There was a stranger." "Yes, there was. I had no barrier against you. You are a listener, Fax, a natural empath, and probably a powerful natural telepath as well. That's why you're the weaver, the one who can keep the tensions and responses of the group running in a self-augmenting pattern until a strain breaks the pattern itself, and you reach through for your answer." He listened with grave interest. "It is strange to see the mysteries of my discipline from outside, through your eyes. I've only seen them from within, as a disciple. If you permit, if you wish, Fax, I should like to communicate with you in mind speech." I was sure now that he was a natural communicant. His consent and a little practice should serve to lower his unwitting barrier. "Once you did that, I would hear what others think?" "No, no. No more than you do already as an empath. Mind speech is communication voluntarily sent and received." "Then why not speak aloud?" "Well, one can lie speaking." "Not mind speaking?" "Not intentionally." Fax considered a while. "That's a discipline that must arouse the interest of kings, politicians, men of business." "Men of business fought against the use of mind speech when it first was found to be a teachable skill. They outlawed it for decades." Bax smiled. And kings? We have no more kings. Yes, I see that. Well, I thank you, Genry, but my business is unlearning, not learning. And I'd rather not yet learn an art that would change the world entirely. By your own foretelling, this world will change, and within 5 years. And I'll change with it, Genry, but I have no wish to change it. It was raining, the long, fine rain of Gathenian summer. We walked under the hemon trees on the slopes above the fastness where there were no paths. Light fell gray among dark branches, clear water dropped from the scarlet needles. The air was chill, yet mild, and full of the sound of rain. Bax, tell me this. You, Handarata, have a gift that men on every world have craved. You have it. You can predict the future. And yet, you live like the rest of us. It doesn't seem to matter. How should it matter, Genry? Well, look. For instance, this rivalry between Carhide and Orgrin, this quarrel about the Sinneth Valley. Carhide has lost face badly these last weeks, I gather. Now, why didn't King Argovan consult his foretellers, asking which course to take, or which member of the Kiaremi to choose as prime minister, or something of that sort? The questions are hard to ask. I don't see why. He might simply ask, who will serve me best as prime minister, and leave it at that. He might, but he doesn't know what serving him best may mean. It might mean the man chosen would surrender the valley to Orgrin, or go into exile, or assassinate the king. It might mean many things he wouldn't expect or accept. He'd have to make his question very precise. Yes. Then there'd be many questions, you see. Even the king must pay the price. You'd charge him high? Very high, said Fax tranquilly. The asker pays what he can afford, as you know. Kings have, in fact, come to the foretellers, but not very often. What if one of the foretellers is himself a powerful man? Indwellers of the fastness have no rank or status. I may be sent to Erinrang, to the Kiaremi. Well, if I go, I take back my status and my shadow, but my foretelling's at an end. If I had a question while I served in the Kiaremi, I go to Orni Fastness there, pay my price, and get my answer. But we in the Handara don't want answers. It's hard to avoid them, but we try to. Facts, I don't think I understand. Well, we come here to the fastnesses mostly to learn what questions not to ask. But you're the answerers. You don't see yet, Genry, why we perfected and practice foretelling? No. To exhibit the perfect uselessness of knowing the answer to the wrong question. I pondered that a good while as we walked side by side through the rain, under the dark branches of the forest of Otherhord. Within the white hood, Fax's face was tired and quiet, its light quenched. Yet he still awed me a little. When he looked at me with his clear, kind, candid eyes, he looked at me out of a tradition 13,000 years old. A way of thought and way of life so old, so well established, so integral and coherent as to give a human being the unself-consciousness, the authority, the completeness of a wild animal, a great strange creature who looks straight at you out of his eternal present. The unknown, said Fax's soft voice in the forest, the unforetold, the unproven, that is what life is based on. Ignorance is the ground of thought. Unproof is the ground of action. If it were proven that there is no God, there would be no religion, no Handara, no Yomish, no hearth gods, nothing. But also, if it were proven that there is a God, there would be no religion. Tell me, Genri, what is known? What is sure, predictable, inevitable? The one certain thing you know concerning your future and mine. That we shall die. Yes. There's really only one question that can be answered, Genri, and we already know the answer. The only thing that makes life possible is permanent, intolerable uncertainty. Not knowing what comes next. Chapter 6. One Way into Orgrin. The cook, who was always at the house very early, woke me up. I sleep sound, and he had to shake me and say in my ear, "Wake up! Wake up, Lord Estevan! There's a runner come from the king's house!" At last I understood him, and confused by sleep and urgency, got up in haste and went to the door of my room where the messenger waited. And so I entered, stark naked and stupid as a newborn child, into my exile. Reading the paper the runner gave me, I said in my mind that I had looked for this, though not so soon. But when I must watch the man nail that damned paper on the door of the house, then I felt as if he might as well be driving the nails into my eyes, and I turned from him and stood blank and bereft, undone with pain, which I had not looked for. That fit passed. I saw to what must be done, and by ninth hour, striking on the gongs, was gone from the palace. There was nothing to keep me long. I took what I could take. As for properties and banked monies, I could not raise cash from them without endangering the men I dealt with. And the better friends they were to me, the worse their danger. I wrote to my old Kemmering, Asha, how he might get the profit of certain valuable things to keep for our son's use, but told him not to try to send me money, for Tibby would have the border watched. I could not sign the letter. To call anyone by telephone would be to send them to jail, and I hurried to be gone before some friend should come in innocence to see me and lose his money and his freedom as a reward for his friendship. I set off west through the city. I stopped at a street crossing and thought, why should I not go east across the mountains and the plains back to Kermland, a poor man afoot, and so come home to Estra where I was born, that stone house on a bitter mountainside. Why not go home? 3 times or 4 I stopped thus and looked back. Each time I saw among the indifferent street faces one that might be the spy sent to see me out of Erenrang, and each time I thought of the folly of trying to go home. As well kill myself. I was born to live in exile, it appeared. And my one way home was by way of dying. So I went on westward and turned back no more. The 3 days' grace I had would see me, given no mishap, at farthest to Cusaban on the gulf, 85 miles. Most exiles have had a night's warning of the order of their exile, and so a chance to take passage on a ship down the Cess before the shipmasters are liable to punishment for giving aid. Such courtesy was not in Tibby's vein. No shipmaster would dare take me now. They all knew me at the port, I having built it for Argovan. No landboat would let me ride, and to the land border from Erenrang is 400 miles. I had no choice but Cusaban, afoot. The cook had seen that. I had sent him off at once, but leaving, he had set out all the ready food he could find done up in a packet, as fuel for my 3 days' run. That kindness saved me, and also saved my courage. For whenever on the road I ate of that fruit and bread, I thought, there's one man thinks me no traitor, for he gave me this. It is hard, I found, to be called traitor. Strange how hard it is, for it's an easy name to call another man. A name that sticks and that fits, that convinces. I was half convinced myself. I came to Kusaben at dusk of the third day, anxious and footsore, for these last years in Erenrang I had gone all to Greece and luxury, and had lost my wind for walking. And there, waiting for me at the gate of a little town, was Asha. 7 years we were Kemmerings, and had 2 sons. Being of his flesh born, they had his name, Forath Remir Osborth, and were reared in that clan hearth. 3 years ago he had gone to Orkney Fastness, and he wore now the gold chain of a celibate of the foretellers. We had not seen each other those 3 years, yet seeing his face in the twilight under the arch of stone, I felt the old habit of our love, as if it had been broken yesterday, and knew the faithfulness in him that had sent him to share my ruin. And feeling that unavailing bond close on me anew, I was angry, for Asha's love had always forced me to act against my heart. I went on past him. If I must be cruel, no need to hide it, pretending kindness. Theram, he called after me, and followed. I went fast down the steep streets of Kusaben toward the wharves. A south wind was blowing up from the sea, rustling the black trees of the gardens, and through that warm, stormy summer dusk, I hastened from him as from a murderer. He caught up with me, for I was too footsore to keep up my pace. He said, "Theram, I'll go with you." I made no answer. 10 years ago, in this month of Tuwa, we took oath. And 3 years ago, you broke it, leaving me, which was a wise choice. I never broke the vow we swore, Theram. True, there was none to break. It was a false vow, a second vow. You know it. You knew it then. The only true vow of faithfulness I ever swore was not spoken, nor could it be spoken. And the man I swore it to is dead, and the promise broken long ago. You owe me nothing, nor I you. Let me go. As I spoke, my anger and bitterness turned from Asha against myself and my own life, which lay behind me like a broken promise. But Asha did not know this, and the tears stood in his eyes. He said, "Will you take this, Theram? I owe you nothing, but I love you well." He held a little packet out to me. "No, I have money, Asha. Let me go. I must go alone." I went on, and he did not follow me. But my brother's shadow followed me. I had done ill to speak of him. I had done ill in all things. I found no luck waiting for me at the harbor. No ship from Orgrin lay in port that I might board and so be off Carhide's ground by midnight as I was bound to be. Few men were on the wharves, and those few all hurrying homeward. The one I found to speak to, a fisherman mending the engine of his boat, looked once at me and turned his back, unspeaking. At that I was afraid. The man knew me. He would not have known unwarned. Tibby had sent his hirelings to forestall me and keep me in Carhide till my time ran out. I had been busy with pain and rage, but not with fear till now. I had not thought that the order of exile might be mere pretext for my execution. Once sixth hour struck, I was fair game for Tibby's men, and none could cry murder, but only justice done. I sat down on a ballast sack of sand, there in the windy glare and darkness of the port. The sea slapped and sucked at the pilings, and fishing boats jogged at their moorings, and out at the end of the long pier burned a lamp. I sat and stared at the light and passed it at darkness over the sea. Some rise to present danger. Not I. My gift is forethought. Threatened closely, I grow stupid and sit on a bag of sand wondering if a man could swim to Orgrin. The ice has been out of Charisun Gulf for a month or two. One might stay alive a while in the water. It is 150 miles to the Argata shore. I do not know how to swim. When I looked away from the sea and back up the streets of Kusaben, I found myself looking for Asha in hopes he still was following me. Having come to that, shame pushed me out of stupor, and I was able to think. Bribery or violence was my choice, if I dealt with that fisherman still at work in his boat in the inner dock. A faulty engine seemed not worth either. Theft, then. But the engines of fishing craft are locked. To bypass the locked circuit, start the engine, steer the boat out of dock, under the pier lamps, and so off to Orgrin, having never run a motorboat, seemed a silly, desperate venture. I had not run a boat, but rowed one on Icefoot Lake in Kerm, and there was a rowboat tied up in the outer dock between two launches. No sooner seen than stolen. I ran out the pier under the staring lamps, hopped into the boat, untied the painter, shipped the oars, and rowed out onto the swelling harbor water where the lights slipped and dazzled on black waves. When I was pretty well away, I stopped rowing to reset the thole of one oar, for it was not working smoothly, and I had, though I hoped to be picked up next day by an Orgata patrol or fisherman, a good bit of rowing to do. As I bent to the oarlock, a weakness ran all through my body. I thought I would faint, and crouched back in a heap on the thwart. It was the sickness of cowardice overcoming me. But I had not known my cowardice lay so heavy in my belly. I lifted my eyes and saw two figures on the pier's end like two jumping black twigs in the distant electric glare across the water. And then I began to think that my paralysis was not an effect of terror, but of a gun at extreme range. I could see that one of them held a 4A gun, and had it been past midnight, I suppose he would have fired it and killed me. But the 4A gun makes a loud noise, and that would want explaining. So they had used a sonic gun. At stun setting, a sonic gun can locate its resonance field only within 100 feet or so. I do not know its range at lethal setting, but I had not been far out of it, for I was doubled up like a baby with colic. I found it hard to breathe, the weakened field having caught me in the chest. As they would soon have a powered boat out to come finish me off, I could not spend any more time hunched over my oars, gasping. Darkness lay behind my back, before the boat, and into the darkness I must row. I rowed with weak arms, watching my hands to make sure I kept hold of the oars, for I could not feel my grip. I came thus into rough water and the dark out on the open gulf. There I had to stop. With each oar stroke the numbness of my arms increased. My heart kept bad time, and my lungs had forgotten how to get air. I tried to row, but I was not sure my arms were moving. I tried to pull the oars into the boat then, but could not. When the sweep light of a harbor patrol ship picked me out of the night like a snowflake on soot, I could not even turn my eyes away from the glare. They unclenched my hands from the oars, hauled me up out of the boat, and laid me out like a gutted blackfish on the deck of the patrol ship. I felt them look down at me, but could not well understand what they said, except for one, the ship's master, by his tone. He said, "It's not sixth hour yet." And again, answering another, "What affair of mine is that? The king exiled him. I'll follow the king's order. No lesser man's." So, against radio commands from Tibby's men ashore, and against the arguments of his mate, who feared retribution, that officer of the Cusaban patrol took me across the Gulf of Charsoon and set me ashore safe in Shelt Port in Orgrin. Whether he did this in Shifgrathor against Tibby's men, who would kill an unarmed man, or in kindness, I do not know. Nasooth, the admirable is inexplicable. I got up on my feet when the Argata coast came gray out of the morning fog, and I made my legs move, and walked from the ship into the waterfront streets of Shelt. But somewhere there I fell down again. When I woke, I was in the Commensal Hospital of Charsoon Coastal Area 4, 24th Commensality, Synethony. I made sure of this, for it was engraved or embroidered in Argotta script on the headpiece of the bed, the lampstand by the bed, the metal cup on the bed table, the nurse's yebs, the bed covers, and the bed shirt I wore. A physician came and said to me, "Why did you resist Dothi?" "I was not in Dothi," I said. "I was in a sonic field." "Your symptoms were those of a person who has resisted the relaxation phase of Dothi." He was a domineering old physician, and made me admit at last that I might have used Dothi strength to counter the paralysis while I rode, not clearly knowing that I did so. Then, this morning, during the Thangan phase, when one must keep still, I had got up and walked, and so near killed myself. When all that was settled to his satisfaction, he told me I could leave in a day or two, and went on to the next bed. Behind him came the inspector. Behind every man in Orgrin comes the inspector. Name? I did not ask him his. I must learn to live without shadows as they do in Orgrin, not to take offense, not to offend uselessly. But I did not give him my land name, which is no business of any man in Orgrin. Theramharth? That is not an Orgotta name. What commensality? Carhide? That is not a commensality of Orgrin. Where are your papers of entry and identification? Where were my papers? I had been considerably rolled about in the streets of Shelt before someone had carted me off to the hospital, where I had arrived without papers, belongings, coat, shoes, or cash. When I heard this, I let go of anger and laughed. At the pit's bottom is no anger.